From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Lonnie Guinier's nomination was still in play, her opponents said she stood for racial polarization. She was called a quota queen and criticized for opposing the one-person, one-vote principle. When President Clinton withdrew her nomination to head the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, Guinier said her views had been misrepresented. On today's Fresh Air, we ask Lonnie Guinier to speak for herself and share her views on voting rights. Also today, Maureen Corrigan reviews Katie Royfe's new book, The Morning After, about date rape and sexual harassment. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has called his top national security advisors to the White House to review the situation in Somalia, and some members of Congress are calling for quick withdrawal of American troops. The president cut short his trip to California after 12 Americans were killed and some were captured in Mogadishu. More than 600 U.S. soldiers headed for Somalia today with tanks, armored vehicles, and helicopters. And President Clinton has threatened retaliation if any U.S. captives are harmed. Some lawmakers said today that the capture of American servicemen could complicate the demand for quick withdrawal. The Italian news agency ANSA reported today that Somali clan leader Mohamed Farah Aidid warned the West not to send more troops to Somalia. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
The Somali warlord effectively warned President Clinton that plans to increase the number of U.S. soldiers in Somalia will only hurt peace prospects. ANSA said Aidid issued the warning in a 20-minute radio broadcast in Mogadishu Monday night. It came after Somali militiamen killed at least 13 UN peacekeepers and wounded dozens in the heaviest battle in Mogadishu since the multinational force was deployed there last December. The U.S. said it will send more troops and arms to Somalia despite Sunday's military losses. President Clinton said at least one U.S. serviceman had been captured by Somali forces and warned that the U.S. would take appropriate action if any prisoners were mistreated. Aidid was quoted as saying that the U.N. operation in Somalia must only facilitate the reestablishment of peace among Somalis. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
President Clinton has ordered the Energy Department to prepare for the possible resumption of nuclear weapons testing. The order came after China conducted a nuclear test earlier today. NPR's Howard Berkus reports that the Department of Energy can have a test ready in a matter of weeks.
An Energy Department spokesman at the Nevada nuclear weapons test site says two test holes were already drilled when Congress imposed a U.S. test ban last fall. Both holes have towers standing above them, containing much of the diagnostic equipment necessary to conduct a test. Missing are the nuclear weapons and testing instruments, which the spokesman says can be in place in a few weeks. The Clinton administration says it wants to be ready to resume nuclear testing next year. The White House says a final decision won't come until after consultations with Congress and U.S. allies, and after comprehensive test ban talks get underway in January. Tests can't resume without congressional approval, and most in Congress have voted to oppose the underground nuclear explosions. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained almost 10 points to close at 3,587. This is NPR News. Syrian President Hafez al-Assad has proposed a summit meeting with President Clinton in an effort to speed up negotiations with Israel. Syria's Foreign Minister Farouk al-Sharaa delivered the proposal today in Washington. He said that such a meeting would help the peace process move beyond Israel's agreement with the Palestinians to an overall settlement with its Arab neighbors. Sharaa appeared at a joint news conference with Secretary of State Warren Christopher, but Christopher made no public response to the proposal for a summit meeting. He said the United States wants to be helpful, but he stressed that the negotiations are between sovereign nations. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat are in Cairo for their first official face-to-face discussions. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
Prime Minister Rabin and Chairman Arafat are meeting with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, but Israeli and Egyptian sources say it's possible Rabin and Arafat will hold private discussions as well. The focus of the talks is implementation of the Israeli PLO peace accord signed in Washington last month. Israel's expressed concern that the PLO hasn't yet set up delegations for detailed negotiations due to begin immediately after the accord takes effect October 13th. Rabin is also expected to bring up continued violence against Israelis despite the PLO's renunciation of terrorism. Arafat, meanwhile, will likely protest the Israeli crackdown on Palestinian hardliners. Last weekend, the PLO accused the Israelis of breaching the Washington Accord when they launched a series of military operations in the Gaza Strip. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
The Clinton administration is preparing to crack down on China and other nations that evade U.S. quotas by shipping their goods through third countries. Jennifer Hillman, the chief U.S. textile negotiator, said that China is believed to transship about $1.5 billion worth of textiles through other countries before sending them to the United States. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Lani Guinier was nominated to head the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, her opponents called her radical and racially obsessed. They said her voting rights agenda was incompatible with the principle of one person, one vote. After President Clinton withdrew her nomination, she said her views had been misrepresented. She said she was frustrated by the political process which denied her an opportunity to plead her case. What are her views on voting rights? We invited her to share them with us. Lani Guinier directed the Voting Rights Project for the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund from 1981 to 88. Since then, she's been a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. I asked her if she's hoping that the scuttling of her nomination will open a debate on voting rights.
Well, I'm hoping that what happened to me and the reaction of the public to the fact that I didn't even get a hearing in which to express my views and to define myself, I'm hoping that that provides an opportunity to talk about some of my ideas and in particular to open up a debate about issues of race and racial justice. I find that the nomination, my nomination, in some ways operated as a metaphor for the unfortunate state of denial in which we find ourselves as a country.
Denial about what?
Denial about issues of race and racism, that it's something that's so controversial we can't even talk about it.
Let's talk about some of the basic things that you have worked for in your career as a lawyer. And some of these things are the things that had became so controversial during the nomination process. I think many people in America define democracy as majority rule. You are saying that majority rule isn't always very fair to people in the minority. What are the shortcomings of majority rule?
When we talk about majority rule, especially in the United States, what we're really talking about is winner-take-all majority rule. That is, 51% of the people get 100% of the power. And the conventional case for the fairness of winner-take-all majority rule is that the majority is not a fixed group, that the majority will rule in the interests of all of the people, because the majority fears that if it does not, the minority will attract some defectors from the majority and then will become a new majority and will do onto the old majority the way it was done onto.
What are the shortcomings of that logic?
Well, the shortcomings of that logic is where you have a fixed permanent majority that does not rule in cooperation with the minority, but rules instead to dominate or exclude or alienate the minority. And those are cases, unfortunately, which I discovered in some of my litigation with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. These are cases where in Phillips County, Arkansas, you had a white majority that dominated a county for a century, where no blacks were elected to any position in the county government, and where in some races, no whites, not a single white person in the entire county, would publicly support any black person running for office. That's a case in which the majority is not ruling in conjunction or cooperation with the minority. That's what James Madison called majority tyranny, not majority rule.
So you're talking about a situation where the minority, even if it's 49%, will be perpetually shut out of the political process.
And that's exactly what happened in Phillips County.
Now, how widespread a problem do you think that is in the United States?
Well, I think it's more widespread than many of us in New York or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. want to admit. It is not necessarily a problem everywhere. And when I was writing my now controversial law review articles, I was not claiming that it was a monolithic problem of a majority throughout the United States. But I identified extreme cases of majority monopoly in local county governments, particularly in the South, but not exclusively.
Now, you have a suggestion for reversing that tyranny of the majority, as you've described it, and it's called cumulative voting. Describe the basics of how that process would work.
Okay. What cumulative voting does is it gives each voter in, let's say, a five-seat race, five votes, and each voter can plump or accumulate their votes in any combination to express the intensity of their preferences. So if a voter felt very strongly about a particular candidate, he or she could give that candidate all five of their votes. If the voter felt strongly about two candidates, they could give one candidate three votes and one candidate two votes. If the voter had no particular preference about any one candidate but wanted to express a preference about who is elected to each of the five seats, then they could just distribute and spread out their votes, giving one vote to five people.
What does that accomplish?
Basically, what cumulative voting does is it allows any politically cohesive minority, not necessarily a racial minority, any politically cohesive minority, to vote strategically to express the intensity of their preferences. And if they are numerically sufficient within the number of seats that are open for election in that particular jurisdiction, they cannot be denied representation. So this particular arrangement, cumulative voting, which, by the way, is used in corporations in at least 30 states in the United States, this particular arrangement gives blacks, if they feel politically cohesive, it gives women, if they feel politically cohesive, it gives Republicans in a Democratic county or Democrats in a conservative Republican county the opportunity to aggregate or accumulate their votes so that they can be represented. It also tends to disaggregate a fixed majority so that, for example, in Chilton County, where cumulative voting was instituted as a remedy for a voting rights case in which the court had found a violation, in Chilton County, where there were seven votes all up at once, three white Republicans, three white Democrats, and one black Democrat were elected for the first time. Prior to the use of cumulative voting, where all of the elections were head-to-head contests in an at-large, winner-take-all, majority rule manner, only white Democrats had been elected during this century.
So it was not only African-Americans who got elected for the first time, it was Republicans.
Yes.
So just to recap here, in cumulative voting, you have one vote per seat. That, like, if there's seven seats up for votes, you have seven votes. There's five seats up for votes, you have five votes. And you can use all those votes for one person, or you could spread out those votes in any pattern that you wish to.
Right. It's a way for voters, essentially, to district themselves by the way they cast their ballots.
Now, we operate on the principle of one person, one vote. Does this kind of voting, the cumulative voting, follow the principle of one person, one vote?
Yes. It basically says each voter has the same number of votes. That's what one person, one vote means. And each voter in a jurisdiction, everyone in Chilton County, Alabama, for example, has seven votes. So everyone has the same number of votes.
So this was like a county legislature that you're giving the example of?
Yes. It was both the county commission and a county school board.
So it's a commission and a school board. How far-reaching do you think cumulative voting should be? Under what circumstances would you recommend using cumulative voting instead of what we do now?
Well, I think it's a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction problem, and it's factually specific. That is, I would recommend cumulative voting as a remedy for a voting rights case where it would be impossible to redistrict the community in a way that was fair, meaning a way that would represent all of the significant groups within the community. One of the places where cumulative voting also works is a place where Latinos or blacks are spread out. In fact, in Chilton County, one of the reasons they adopted cumulative voting is that they couldn't really redistrict to capture, quote unquote, all of the blacks who lived in the county. Although blacks lived in segregated areas, the segregated areas were dispersed throughout the county, so a districting solution did not resolve the unfairness that the court had identified in the winner-take-all at-large election.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lonnie Guinier. Is the assumption in cumulative voting that people vote in blocks, that African Americans are likely to vote for an African American candidate, or that Latinos are likely to vote for a Latino candidate? Therefore, if all the African Americans and all the Latinos put all their votes, behind the African American or Latino candidate, that would ensure them getting in?
Well, in the cases that I've described, that's not an assumption. That's a proven fact. In other words, before the court would intervene and order a remedy, the court must first find the existence of racially polarized voting. It must first find that the black minority or the Latino minority that is bringing this lawsuit under the Voting Rights Act is a politically cohesive community that votes in a way that expresses a sense of community or a sense of distinctive interests. And it must find that the white community, voting also as a racial bloc, is not supporting candidates of choice by the Latino or African American minority. There is also the opportunity for blacks and Latinos using cumulative voting to move beyond identifying solely in racial terms, and that's one of its advantages.
How does that happen?
Because the black community can vote strategically to support a black candidate, or it can join with other groups within the larger community to form coalitions to support a feminist or to support an environmentalist. If people choose to identify in terms of their racial identity, they can. But it also allows people to choose the identity that fits for the purpose of that particular election. No one is districted into a particular identity. No one is required to vote based on other people's assumptions about their identity.
Now, just to clarify, would you like to see this kind of cumulative voting adapted throughout the United States or only in local areas as a remedy for racism?
I am not a partisan of cumulative voting. I am a democratic idealist. So I believe that there are many possible reforms that should be adopted throughout the United States to open up the political process. My particular discussion of cumulative voting was limited to cases in which a court had found a violation of the Voting Rights Act and then was attempting to implement a remedy to cure that proven violation.
So you're recommending it where a remedy is needed?
That is what I have discussed so far, but I think that cumulative voting also represents an aspiration, a possibility, a vision for democracy that would be more participatory and more empowering of all voters. So I think it's certainly something to consider, but I am not urging it as a remedy or mandating it nationwide.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lonnie Guinier, and she was nominated to head the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, but President Clinton withdrew the nomination. She used to direct the Voting Rights Project for the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund. She's now a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Lonnie Guinier is my guest. For about 8 years, you directed the Voting Rights Project for the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund. What led you in the direction of voting rights? You've spent a good deal of your professional career litigating in that area.
I think it was a natural transition because I started at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in 1981 when the Voting Rights Act was up for renewal. And I worked on extending and amending the Voting Rights Act and succeeded, along with a large coalition of civil rights and good government groups, in working with Congress to pass the 1982 amendments.
Let's do a little bit of history here on the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. Refresh our memories about the basics of that act.
Okay, the act was passed initially in response to widespread defiance by southern jurisdictions of the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. In 1965, there were some counties in the South in which blacks were a majority of the people, and yet there were no black registered voters, or there were very few black registered voters, not because blacks didn't want to vote, but because the white-dominated jurisdictions were engaged in ingenious devices to thwart the political aspirations of blacks. There were literacy tests, there were
good character tests,
understanding clauses, all of which were administered in a discriminatory manner to allow illiterate whites to vote, but to deny even blacks with PhDs the opportunity to register and vote. The 65 Act responded to that by through a number of provisions, and they were very successful. One of the most successful provisions was Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which essentially created an administrative preclearance process in which any covered jurisdiction had first, before it made a voting change, had to submit that change to the Justice Department for preclearance review. This was an effort to monitor the southern jurisdictions. And I say southern jurisdictions because this was where at the time the problem was concentrated. This was an effort to monitor those jurisdictions so that they could not come up with some new device once blacks were registered to thwart black political aspirations. And in fact, the second generation of voting rights cases represented an effort to deal with exactly that problem.
After the Voting Rights Act was passed in 65, and it did away with the obstacles that white people had created to prevent black people from registering to vote, there were some new obstacles that were put up to getting fair representation. What were those obstacles, the obstacles that required an amending of the Voting Rights Act in 1982?
Well, in response to the enfranchisement of millions of black voters, some southern jurisdictions changed their method of election away from single-member districts to winner-take-all, majority-rule, at-large elections. This system allowed the white majority to decide the outcome of every election. So even though blacks could register and vote, they never could elect a representative of their choice to serve in the governing body.
No, why not?
Because the white majority voted as a racial bloc to exclude the black minority. The white majority, if there were five seats up at large, essentially elected all five representatives. And this is what I referred to earlier as racial bloc voting, where the white community refused to vote for any representatives of the black community. In one case I litigated in North Carolina, 81.7% of the whites in that state, on average, would not vote for a black candidate, even if their choice was to vote for no one.
But weren't there districts where the majority of the voters would have been black and could have voted in a black candidate?
Yes, and it was exactly those districts that were changed, were eliminated. And it was this kind of change to an at-large election scheme that thwarted the aspirations of black voters.
You were one of the people who successfully got the Voting Rights Act amended in 1982. What were the amendments?
The particular amendment that has the most significance today is an amendment to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. That amendment established that blacks, Latinos, or any protected minority had an equal opportunity to elect representatives of their choice, and that in order to establish a violation of the statute under this amendment, the minority plaintiffs had to show the particular voting scheme resulted in discrimination. They did not have to show that the particular voting scheme, such as an at-large election, was intentionally discriminatory. And the reason that change was significant was that when the Supreme Court had ruled that intent was a necessary element of a plaintiff's case, it had specified that minority plaintiffs challenging an at-large system in Mobile, which had a clear and obvious discriminatory effect, was nevertheless okay because the black plaintiffs had failed to prove with direct evidence that the at-large scheme was maintained for discriminatory reasons.
I guess intent is very difficult to prove, too.
It was particularly hard to prove in that case because the at-large system had been adopted 100 years earlier. And in order to prove that it was intentionally discriminatory, the black plaintiffs would have to go back and show what was in the minds of legislators who are now long dead. By the way, they did succeed in doing that, but it also required the expenditure of several hundred thousand dollars.
So you consider the work that you're doing now an extension of the work that you did amending the Voting Rights Act because things are not still functioning in a completely fair way in many parts of our country.
Yes. In fact, one of the beauties of the Voting Rights Act and one of the reasons it has been the most successful civil rights law ever passed, in my opinion, as well as in the opinion of many observers, is the fact that it is a flexible statute. It is a statute that attempts to eliminate any form of discrimination from the political process. It is a statute that was passed initially to defy or thwart ingenious schemes that were continuously adopted to avoid the reach of a federal court decree. In the whole history of voting, originally when blacks challenged, for example, the white primaries, they first challenged the primary in Texas. And so the state, which had required by law that only whites could vote in the Democratic Party primary, simply changed the rule and delegated to the state Democratic Party Executive Committee the requirement of establishing membership rules. Then the black plaintiffs had to go back and challenge the Democratic Executive Committee's rules, which also limited voting only to whites. And then the Democratic Executive Committee delegated that responsibility to the Democratic Party Convention. So it would take 30 or 40 years simply to establish one right to vote in one community.
I know when Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas, you sued the state of Arkansas to change its voter registration practices. What was that lawsuit about? I believe you won that suit.
Well, we settled the case, although after the president nominated me at a ceremony in the Justice Department, and after he had announced that one of his nominees had sued him, he came over to me and whispered, I'm glad you didn't say that you won that suit. So he sees it as are having won the suit. We basically settled the suit, which represented an effort to liberalize the voter registration procedures in Arkansas, which had been very anachronistic and idiosyncratic.
An example?
In some communities, they refused to deputize volunteers to register voters, and the officials who were the exclusive custodians of the voter registration mechanisms or machinery would refuse to go out to parts of the community to register voters because they said they'd already been there 3 months earlier. So it was a very tight, closed process, and it did not enable a lot of people to actually register in large rural counties.
Lonnie Guinier is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Lonnie Guinier will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more with Lonnie Guinier, President Clinton's former nominee to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. Guinier's father was the first chairperson of Harvard's African American Studies Department. Her mother is white and Jewish. We'll talk about how growing up in an interracial family shaped Guinier's goals and commitments. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Katie Royfe's new book, The Morning After, about date rape and sexual harassment. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Military officials are sending more than 600 U.S. troops to Somalia, along with helicopters designed for nighttime raids and evacuations. Many of the 12 U.S. soldiers killed and more than 70 others wounded over the weekend were pinned down near the crash site of a U.S. helicopter. The Pentagon has declined to comment on reports that up to 8 Americans are held prisoners by supporters of fugitive factional leader General Adid. One has been shown in a videotape. President Clinton summoned his top national security advisors to the White House late today to discuss the situation. Before returning to Washington from a trip to California, President Clinton spoke to a gathering of senior citizens in a suburb of Los Angeles, and he spoke about health care reform. NPR's Patricia Naymond reports.
Asking several hundred members of the American Association of Retired Persons to support his health reform plan, President Clinton stressed the benefits for seniors: coverage for prescription drugs, which is not now covered by Medicare, the federal insurance program for the elderly, and a promise to phase in long-term care coverage by the year 2000. The president told seniors that Medicare would remain intact, but he said payments to doctors and hospitals under the program would be held down in order to save money. He said this would not affect the quality of care delivered, and added that seniors will have more choices under reform. They can either stay in the Medicare program or enroll in their local health alliance, which would give them a variety of health plans from which to choose. I'm Patricia Naymond reporting.
UN officials in Bosnia have warned that the situation in one besieged area of the nation has grown worse. And according to amateur radio operators, people are dying of starvation and shelling. Matt Fry reports for the BBC.
Almost 150,000 people, mostly Muslims, are fighting off Serbian and Croatian forces in the Maglaj Tešin pocket. This is the second biggest siege after Sarajevo. But while shelling in the capital has died down, the situation in the pocket has been described by the UN as dramatic. The daily average of incoming shells is about 160. One-third of the UN airdrops of food are estimated to miss their targets. Hundreds of people have thus resorted to eating wild mushrooms. At least four people have died from mushroom poisoning. Because the UN hasn't been allowed into the besieged pocket, there is no independent confirmation. But UN relief workers here describe the accounts as very plausible. Alliances and the three-way conflict in Bosnia are shifting more and more, often in contradictory ways. In Maglaj, the Serbs are fighting the Muslims. In Mostar, they have given them artillery to fight the Croats. Meanwhile, in Bihać in the west, Muslims are battling Muslims. There are no permanent friends or enemies here, just momentary interests.
Matt Fry reporting from Sarajevo. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 9 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton has spoken by telephone again with Russian leader Boris Yeltsin. White House officials say that the Russian president has assured Mr. Clinton that he will go ahead with free elections for a new parliament this December. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today it's crucial that presidential elections be held in a timely fashion. Yeltsin has said that presidential elections will be held in June. The White House said that Yeltsin thanked President Clinton for his support and said that order has now been restored in Moscow. The Los Angeles police sergeant convicted in the Rodney King beating will have to report to prison by Tuesday of next week. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected Stacey Coon's petition to remain free on bail while his conviction is being appealed. Yesterday, the High Court rejected a similar request from Lawrence Powell, who also was convicted of violating King's civil rights. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
Stacey Kuhn and Lawrence Paul were to have reported to prison last week, but Federal District Judge John Davies allowed them to remain free while the Supreme Court considered their requests for bail. Attorneys for both men have argued that the two pose no threat to society and could easily serve their entire 30-month sentences only to have their convictions overturned later by a higher court. This argument was rejected, however, by both the district and appeals courts on the grounds that bail is not granted when there has been a crime of violence. Now, that argument has also been rejected by the United States Supreme Court, which ruled without comment. Paul and Kuhn will serve their time at Dublin Federal Work Camp, a minimum security facility on a military base about 40 miles east of San Francisco. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Officials of the Shell Oil Company have announced a major oil discovery in the Gulf of Mexico. Officials say the find should produce more than 700 million barrels of crude oil over the next 30 years. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with part two of our interview with Lonnie Guinier. She was in the headlines every day when her opponents were trying to shoot down the president's nomination of her to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. She says she was demonized, and she didn't recognize the Lonnie Guinier her opponents made her out to be. In the first part of our interview, we discussed her views on voting rights. We also wanted to find out a little bit about her personal background. We're talking about your views of fair representation, and that reminds me of a story you told to a class at Yale where you went to law school. And you have a paper on this as well, in which you talked about how unrepresented you felt when you were in law school. And you told the story of one law professor who looked out on his classroom, and you and several other women were in the classroom, and he said what?
"Good morning, gentlemen." And he explained that those of us who were not gentlemen should not feel insulted because he had been teaching for a long time, and he had the habit of addressing his classes as gentlemen, and it was a hard habit for him to break.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, I felt silenced. I felt as if I was really not there in that class as far as this professor was concerned.
Kind of like, well, you might be excluded if I use the word gentleman, but gosh, that's a hard habit to break, so you understand.
It was not a very welcoming feeling, although I have to say that I went back to Yale Law School in the spring of 1993. I addressed a large assembly of students and faculty at the law school in the same room where I had sat almost 20 years ago studying business units, and I noticed that in that room they now have a portrait of Judge Leon Higginbotham, and that made a big difference to me. Not only was the portrait there, but the assembled faces in the audience were much more diverse than when I had been at Yale Law School.
Your father was the first chair of Harvard's African American Studies Department. I'm wondering, when you were growing up, if he talked to you a lot about race consciousness and about the political need for change and so on. I mean, if you felt inspired in part because of him to go in the political direction that you've headed in.
I don't know if I'd call it a political direction. My father talked to me about justice, and he talked to me about injustice, and he talked to me about the responsibility of those of us to whom much has been given to try and make this society better for all of its members. And it was his commitment to fighting injustice that inspired me. In some ways, the most memorable story that my father ever told me about his own life was a story from his days at Harvard College in 1929. He had been admitted to Harvard College, but was not given any financial aid. The school claimed that he had not sent in a picture with his application, but according to my father, the real reason was that they had already given one full scholarship to one black student who lived in Cambridge, and therefore they had a quota of one, and my father could not get any financial aid. He also was not allowed to live in the dormitories because they had never had a black person living in the dormitories at that time, except for the relative of a United States senator. And what I remember about that story was the sense of isolation and exclusion that my father felt when he described going to Lamont Library and seeing people that he knew from his high school who would not speak to him at Harvard, although they were friendly with him the year before when he had been in high school. He said that the only person who voluntarily approached him and said something friendly in his first year at Harvard was Ralph Bunche, whom he met in the Harvard bookstore.
You said that your father said that something about that, you know, that those of us who have much, who have been given much, have a responsibility to those who haven't. Did you come from a family that had been given much? Did you come from a family that thought of itself as privileged?
He wasn't talking about much financially, because through most of my childhood we were struggling.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about a family that had a commitment, an intellectual commitment, and an understanding of, based on principle and based on a vision of an integrated and more inclusive society, that it was that understanding that we should share with more people.
Your mother was white.
She still is.
Your mother is white, yes. When you were growing up in a racially mixed family, was there any pressure on you to identify more with one race than another?
There was not any pressure from my family, but there was certainly pressure from my peers. And in fact, when I went to junior high school, it was clear to me that I was black. And the reason it was clear is that I took the bus with all of the black kids from the, quote, black part of town. And there were lines of demarcation. We could be friendly in school. And in fact, there were lots of kids at the junior high school who reached out during school hours. But once you got on that bus, you were clearly either black or white. And I was black.
So one lesson you learned was that other people sometimes decide who they think you are.
Right.
Did you grow up in a black neighborhood?
Well, it was actually it started out as a white neighborhood until we moved in. I'm not saying that we alone changed the neighborhood, but it was in a period of transition. Everyone on my block before we moved in was white, and within 10 years, everyone on the block was black.
And you stayed on the block?
Yes.
How long did you live there?
Well, actually, my parents lived there from when I was 6 until I was 19, and then they moved to Cambridge when my father became chair of the Afro-American Studies program at Harvard.
You're just joining us. My guest is Lani Guinier, and she was nominated to head the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. President Clinton withdrew the nomination. She directed the Voting Rights Project for the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund from 1981 to 88. She's now a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lani Guinier. How were there like turning points in your life where you felt just a growing sense of awareness of, you know, what race means in America and how it divides people?
Actually, one of those turning points was when I went to junior high school and I realized that I was being specifically accepted by the black students and not accepted by the white students because of both how I looked and where I came from. Another turning point was when I ran for a position in the student government at Andrew Jackson High School in Queens. This was a large public high school. It was a period of great overcrowding. There were about 6,000 students in the high school. And I had been encouraged to run by the school guidance counselor who was trying to integrate the governing body of the school. The school was racially mixed. It was probably 50% black and 50% white at the time. It may even have been 60% white. And none of the elected officials were black. And he felt that it was important that all of the groups at the school, there were also some Latinos and some Asian Americans, and he felt it was important that all of the groups at the school be part of the student government. And he recruited another black woman and me to run for positions on the student government. And I was the victim of racial black voting. I lost by 13 votes, which essentially tracked the racial composition of the school.
So blacks voted black, whites voted white.
That's one way of looking at what happened.
Roger Wilkins wrote a profile of you in Esquire in 1984. And you said about your mother in that, "My mother helped me to see the other person's side and not to internalize rejection and to be able to fight back." Talk about rejection. when your nomination was withdrawn for the Justice Department, and when, you know, newspapers around the country were either supporting you or condemning you, and politicians around the country were supporting you or condemning you, did you internalize the rejection?
Well, I certainly tried to follow my mother's advice. I tried not to see the issue in personal terms, but in political terms. I was the messenger who was being punished for bringing the country the bad news about our racial situation. I didn't take it personally, although, of course, I felt, as someone said, disappointed.
Right. What do you think you learned about the political process from how your nomination was handled?
I think that many mistakes were made, some of which were peculiar to questions of timing or to incompetence at a particular stage in this administration. But I also think that there are larger messages which extend beyond my personal experience. I think the political process is afraid of controversy. And I think the political process, particularly the Senate Judiciary Committee in Washington, is not providing us leadership because so many politicians are afraid of talking about controversial issues. And they're particularly afraid of talking about controversial issues that deal with race. I think we're in a state of denial about issues of race and racism. One of the reasons may be that the prior administrations had been so successful in playing the race card and in polarizing people so that we are convinced now that if we start to talk about these controversial issues, that we will be contributing to this polarization. I happen to think that you don't identify or solve a problem by silence. I think that you have to talk about a problem and talk it through in order to help solve it.
Did anyone accuse you of playing the race card during the nomination?
They didn't accuse me of playing any cards because I was gagged. I wasn't allowed to speak during the period that my nomination was pending as a, quote, courtesy to the Senate, which should hear from me first during my confirmation hearings. But those people who claimed to have read my writings and those people who were recycling some of the accusations about me that had first surfaced in very partisan ways by political opponents, they claimed that because I talked about racial divisions, that I was race-obsessed.
What was it like for you to be the subject of national debate, to feel that your views were being misrepresented, and yet to be told that you shouldn't really discuss your views in public yet?
It was a public nightmare. It was awful.
Do you feel like you've recovered from that?
Well, I've tried not to see myself again as the victim.
Mm-hmm.
I have tried to see myself as a woman who has an issue, not a grievance.
What's the difference between an issue and a grievance?
Well, a grievance is basically someone who's saying, feel sorry for me. I have been wronged. And a woman with an issue is saying there are some positive lessons that we can learn from what happened to me, and there are issues of fundamental fairness that affect the political process on a macro level in terms of some of the ideas that I've talked about in my writings, and on a micro level in terms of the way in which I was not given an opportunity to define myself or defend myself.
Just curious, have you spoken much to the president since the nomination was withdrawn?
No, I haven't spoken to him at all.
Okay. How has this affected your stature as a professor at the University of Pennsylvania? I don't mean with the administration. I mean with the students. You know, students just registered a few weeks ago are now, I mean, you're something of a celebrity now, you know, so has that increased the popularity of your classes?
Well, I think you're right that students see me differently. I think some of the students have internalized some of the criticisms, particularly students who don't know me. Mm-hmm. And so they are concerned that I may be a radical or that I may be race-obsessed, which had never been an issue before this. There are certainly many students, however, who have come to seek me out who hadn't heard of me before.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Lani Guinier is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams from National Public Radio in Washington with a word about what's coming up on All Things Considered. We'll talk with Paul Watson of the Toronto Star about today's situation in Somalia, in the capital Mogadishu. Mohamed Farah Aidid has been on the radio there appealing for support. Raqia Omar of the human rights group Africa Rights says the United States should stay in Somalia, but should try much harder for a political settlement. Martha Raddatz reports on the Pentagon's analysis of the military situation in Mogadishu. Also, wrap-up reports from Moscow, Mike Schuster on the politics, and Peter Breslow visits a hospital in Moscow. That and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
In June, when the New York Times Magazine printed an excerpt from Katie Royfe's new book, The Morning After, it sparked a storm of angry letters to the editor. And the controversy has escalated since the book's publication a few weeks ago. Katie Royfe argues that contemporary feminism's focus on issues like date rape and sexual harassment promotes a 19th century view of women as being the fragile victims of male desire. But commentator Maureen Corrigan says Royfe's book preaches another popular 19th century prescription for women, one in which they're told to see no evil, hear no evil, and above all, speak no evil.
After reading The Morning After, I feel like I have Katie Royfe pegged. Royfe, who's only 25, reminds me of a type of female student I sometimes meet in the women's literature courses I teach. This student, understandably, wants to learn about great women who've written masterpieces, had terrific love lives, and leapt tall buildings in a single bound. But when we also discuss writers whose careers were thwarted because of their gender, this student will complain the class is too negative. I don't blame her. When I was 19, I didn't want to hear that being a woman could limit me either. Back then, I wanted to believe I was invincible. Hear me roar. Well, it's not that easy. But some women, like Katie Royfe, want a feminist movement that sings only inspirational anthems, instead of one that also sounds disturbing alarms about sexual harassment, discrimination, and rape. Royfe tells us she grew up in a feminist household. In fact, her mother, Anne Royfe, wrote the popular women's movement novel, Up the Sandbox. But when Royfe arrived at Harvard, she says she encountered a different feminism from the empowering kind her mother taught her. There were orientation sessions where counselors passed out condoms and cautioned female students to consider every man a potential rapist. There were Take Back the Night marches where weeping women stood before microphones and shared the details of their rapes with crowds of strangers. And at Princeton, where Royfe is now a grad student, she says the Gothic tranquility of the campus is marred by dozens of blue security lights. Royfe claims the blue lights, the marches, and the date rape workshops all give young women the same damaging message. Feel vulnerable. Be afraid of sex. Think of yourself as a victim. To give Royfe her due, I think she's right when she argues that rape as a metaphor is invoked too freely. And things like the Take Back the Night marches and speeches can degenerate into what Royfe calls group exhibitionism. But Royfe turns her dislike of the confessional style of those speeches into a general dismissal of their content. And Royfe also displays shaky reasoning when she disputes the oft-quoted figure that 1 in 4 college women will be the target of sexual assault. She asks, "If 25% of my female friends were really being raped, wouldn't I know it?" Royfe wants to have it both ways. She wants to write her personal impressions about contemporary feminism, but then she also wants to build a large structural criticism of feminism based on nothing but her personal impressions. It's true, we can't live our lives as if deep structures of inequality will always block our aspirations. But Katie Royfe's Nike feminism, Just Do It, waves away tough, enduring problems. Heroes are inspiring, but as Brecht wrote, pity the nation that needs heroes. Instead, we need a politics that will make Ayn Rand wannabes like Katie Royfe unnecessary.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Katie Royfe's new book, The Morning After. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease, research assistance from Peter Clowney. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Walter Kern's novel, She Needed Me, is about a right-to-life activist and a woman seeking an abortion who fall in love. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Kern about his novel, which is just out in paperback, and his own experiences coming of age in the Mormon Church. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.